Okay. Gosh. When I was looking at the candles, it reminded me of a quote from Karl Barth. So I just found it on my system, so I'll just read it. It says thus, Jesus Christ, his history became and is the foundation of Christian existence, this and this alone. The Christian comes from him, from his history, from knowledge of it. He also looks back thereto. His is the ground on which he stands and walks. His is the air which he breathes. His is the word he has in his ears before, above, and after all other words. His is the light, the one light, the incomparably bright light which illumines him. Which I think is beautiful, actually. But I'm Neil, if you don't know me. I found myself, in sort of a gentle way, eagerly looking forward to this morning. Firstly, to make amends for the relatively dismal effort I made last time I was here, and I had the privilege, but mainly because I know that when I do have the privilege, I am among, cliches notwithstanding, a kindred-hearted community, and I can contribute and say mostly what I'm thinking. Last time I spoke along these lines, however, my best friend who was in the congregation afterwards said, well, you managed to offend, I think, everybody. So hopefully this morning I'll be able to follow along with that as well. My intention is to finish with some practical, if biased, thoughts that may or may not help. So today the conversation that we're having is in the light of James chapter 3, particularly verses 13 to 19, which I'll read in a little while. James is especially concerned that we enthusiastically build, and I know you looked at James earlier on, so I know you know this, that we build peaceful and safe communities where people can belong and have the opportunity to flourish. Family, friends, Christians, local communities, LGBTI communities, broader global communities. That is at the heart of James, and I believe at the heart of Christian spirituality. That's what I would say. I would say that the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit are in a community dance, using Dave Andrews' ideas. The creation of earth and people together, living in the unforced rhythms of grace. It sounds a rather lofty end, I guess, doesn't it, as I read it, and I'm not at all sure it's fully attainable. What I am sure of, though, is the decidedly unlofty means through which a decent community has a shot at being built, which is Jesus and you and me. Jesus leading and you and me following on a risky, really, wisdom-strewn road where home may not be just around the next bend, but still worth the walking, because, of course, home is in the walking, isn't it, anyway? So I want to talk a little bit, I guess, about wisdom and our community, a road less travelled. I live just across the freeway, and so I feel a part of this community. Robert Frost said, and wrote The Road Not Taken. I'm going to read it out. It'll be the first of two poems this morning. The next one is my own, because Michael Prince wouldn't give me any of his. Two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and sorry I could not travel both and be one traveller. Long I stood and looked down one as far as I could to where it bent in the undergrowth. Then took the other as just as fair, and having perhaps the better claim because it was grassy and wanted wear. Though as for that, the passing there had warned them really about the same. And both that morning equally lay in leaves no step had trodden back. Oh, I kept the first for another day, yet knowing how way leads on to way, I doubted if I should ever come back. I shall be telling this with a sigh, somewhere ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less travelled by, and that has made all the difference. Now, I know it's just me, but I really do believe it's way past time to follow Jesus on this less travelled road. You know that road where sinners and tax collectors, men of ill repute, and women who waste perfume are dancing with us as we walk towards and with the light of the world. And where children are not marginalised by Christians who don't appear to care about or even understand wisdom, but more on that later. I have to admit, I sort of came late to this idea of community. I didn't have it growing up. And But I think now I, in a difficult and complex way, I think I agree with Eugene Peterson, who said, "I didn't come to the conviction easily, but finally there was no getting around it. There can be no maturity in the spiritual life, no obedience in following Jesus, no wholeness in the Christian life apart from an immersion and embrace of community. I am not myself by myself. Community, not the highly vaunted individualism of our culture, is the setting in which Christ is at play." And with the world community seemingly in turmoil, a Sunday sermon does seem a little bit disconnected from real life for me. And yet, I'm convinced that we can localise the bedrock wisdom that is found in James. So James is a leader of early Christian community. He's a practical pastor. He's a practical, everyday Christ follower. He's a down-to-earth, salt-of-the-earth kind of a guy. A grassroots kind of a person, as I read it. He's a real practical guy, but practical doesn't mean unspiritual. In fact, I would probably go as far as saying that trying to separate your everyday going to work, cleaning your teeth, the house, the kids, trying to separate that from spirituality, I reckon, is bogus spirituality. It's certainly not Christ-following spirituality. Being kind and decent to others is probably one of the most practical and spiritual challenges that there can be, and challenges that certainly we all face every day. So James' skillful advice, I think, does resonate as much today as it did a couple of thousand years ago. In fact, James chapter 3 could almost have been written this year or even this week in Melbourne or Sydney. Some excerpts from verse 2 to 16 of chapter 3. Let me just read it out. "We get it wrong nearly every time we open our mouths." This is in the Message paraphrase. "It only takes a spark, remember, to set off a forest fire. A careless or wrongly placed word out of your mouth can do that. By our speech we can ruin the world, turn harmony to chaos, throw mud on a reputation, send the whole world up in smoke, and go up in smoke with it. Smoke right from the pit of hell." And these words are coming straight after chapter 2's assertion, I'm sure you'll remember, claiming that words that are claiming faith are authenticated by actions, that there should be a symbiotic, cooperative relationship between what we say and what we do. Unfortunately, this last while, I think we've been almost overwhelmed by the ruination that can be wrought when words and actions spring from what Peterson called the pit of hell. I wrote a poem. It's called "Misery Loves Company." "It is so desperately safe to walk the boundary fences of our lives, but never venture across the uncertain distance of no man's land, where danger may lie in wait to make a claim on our soul. Be it between black or white or left and right, war and such teach wrong, that no man's land is found between two poles that share hatred for the other, rather than the land they share and should explore. The Cordite mist of battles past still suffocates, once military, now orthodoxy, hanging like clouds of danger, no man's land for the daring soul, exploring light in darkness and darkness in life, and finding kindness. Danger, do not enter, scrawled on the fence by the barren and empty who project their predicament on the wasteland of their warped hope. Transforming worlds and words into handcuffs. Ideological restraints that prove misery loves company." So I can't leave it any longer to tell a story that's really close to my heart, or a story within a story. I was with two pastors, a couple of months ago. And one of them, they were talking about gay marriage. And one of them had been, a lot of his congregation had been challenging him to phone his local member to make sure that his local member was holding the line on gay marriage. And so this guy said, so I rang my local member and he assured me that he was holding the line. And I'm sitting there going, oh, feeling a little bit like I'm feeling right now actually, but maybe worse. And I said, "Can I tell you a story, guys?" I said, "Yeah." And I said, "There's these twins. Their name's Jacob and Lucas." to they're 2 years old. And I'm the surrogate grandfather and my wife is the surrogate grandmother for them because their grandfather, Josh's dad, has got motor neurons disease, end stage, and so he can't really do anything at all. He can only just move his one finger at the moment and breathe. And that's been like that for the last 6 months or so. And so he's asked us, because we've known Josh since he was about 14 or so, when he was babysitting our kids when they were growing up, he's asked us if we would be like grandparents, and so we've took on that responsibility wholeheartedly. And they're beautiful, just by the way. They're beautiful. Anyway, and I said, but you know what? Here's something really interesting. They were born to Indian surrogacy, to two gay men who were married in Canada. So I said to these guys, with the looks of semi-shock, but trying not to be shocked, look in their faces, I said, yeah, they got the whole nine yards, haven't they? They got the whole shebang. They missed nothing. Indian surrogacy, with all the, you know, the myriad complexities of that, and these two gay men. But then I said this. I said, but here's the thing. These two boys exist. They're not a discussion to be had. They're children. And I said, the Bible that you say you believe calls them God's creation. So I said, while you are having your discussions about what is and isn't okay, remember these two boys. And I would suggest that we all need to do that when it comes to any issue, actually. Take the time to spend some time. Be with rather than against. And find out the great joy and gift that every person can bring to community. But I do, I mean, that sounds pretty hardcore, and it is, and I'm sure it shocked them. And well, I hope it did. And it's not the first time I've said it. And actually, yesterday I got all teary, sitting with my wife, just sitting with Kelly, watching the footy. And I don't know how the subject got brought up, probably because it was just resonating deeply within me, because of the absurdity of what happened in New South Wales this week, when women, girls at a girls' school couldn't watch a video that would actually help rather than hinder. And I started crying. Kel said, calm down, you know. I said, I'm trying to be calm. I'm trying to be calm. But this, I said, you get between me and Jacob and Lucas, you're in trouble. You're in trouble if you get between me and them. You're in real trouble. I would suggest that standing in the gap, to be biblical. I would suggest that's standing in the gap. Not saying disrespectful things from the hilltops. That's anyway, so you can see how this offended the last group that I was talking to. Because it was the Church of Christ. And they, you know, they can tend to be a little bit churchy. Now, the hypocrisy of me speaking about this, of course, is that I'm talking about the Church of Christ, or I mentioned them, and I'm only just trying to grasp and live this stuff anyway, because, of course, the sting in the tail here is I can say that with this passion, and I know it's difficult to disagree in one respect because, you know, if I disagree with him, is, you know, I'm disagreeing with these kids. But the hypocrisy of it is, of course, that if I say hateful things about the people that are saying hateful things, I'm, of course, in the same camp. I end up being in the same thing. I end up breaking faith with my faith. If I do that as well, you know, it's a difficult place to be in. I was at my middle son's valedictory Eucharist at his school last year. It was his final year 12, and it was really fantastic. I know there's a couple of hundred boys, I guess, and their parents, and even though I think probably most of the kids wouldn't name Christ as being followers of Christ, but there's something about they're all singing the Lord of the Dance together, and it was just fantastic. And then they sang that song from Isaiah 6:9, which I won't try to sing, but it's I will go, you know, I've heard you calling in the night, I've heard you calling in the night, I will go, Lord, if you lead me, I will hold your people in my heart. Now, I'm getting a bit teary because of all the kids singing. It was a beautiful moment. And then I got even more teary because as I sing these words, I will go, Lord, if you send me or ask me, I will hold your people in my heart. I was singing those words, a little bit teary, and I felt in my heart, almost like the Holy Spirit saying, oh yeah, right. You'll hold my people in your heart, will you? You hate them. You dislike them. So don't sing what you don't believe. This was kind of happening, you know, how that dialogue happens in a moment. You don't. It's not like I've heard sentences. But I could hear that the Spirit was saying to me, mate, in paraphrase, mate, I totally applaud your experiences and your willingness to share, but I don't applaud your willingness to put the people that I hold in my heart so dearly down. And it was really challenging. It was really challenging. And then this other kind of word came to me, which was, but I'd really like for you to do that, so will you? And I had to make a decision. You know, what am I going to do? Am I actually going to live what Jesus talked about beyond where it works for me or where it fits for my particular philosophical leanings or my life experience? Am I going to be prepared to do that? And so I did make that decision, and to be honest, I'm still a bit conflicted about it, because I just can't see how a community of faith should always be over and against some other community. I just don't understand how that would be the case. But Pharisees are challenging people. So I guess Jesus loved them and so must we. Let me read a bit of Matthew 15, verses 16 to 20. We'll get to James in a sec. Jesus replied, but what comes out of the mouth gets its start in the heart. It's from the heart that we vomit up evil arguments, murders, adulteries, fornications, thefts, lies and cussing. That's what pollutes. Eating or not eating certain foods, washing or not washing your hands, that's neither here nor there. So Jesus is suggesting that there's a symbiotic or cooperative relationship here between what we say, what we do, and what's going on in our hearts. So we can sort of see the first one, what we say and what we do. James challenges us on that. And then Jesus, I think, goes to a whole other level and says, well, that's actually about what are the convictions of your heart. What's actually coming out of there, because that will tend then to come out in words and actions. So maybe it could be said that living in community is really about your heart, words and actions. I think convictions motivate. And I think our challenge is to let our convictions motivate us to have a crack at becoming what the end of chapter 3 of James talks about, this robust, healthy community. In fact, let me read it. James 3, verses 13 to 19. It says, do you want to be counted wise, to build a reputation for wisdom? Here's what you do. Live well, live wisely, live humbly. It's the way you live, not the way you talk, that counts. Mean-spirited ambition isn't wisdom. Boasting that you are wise isn't wisdom. Twisting the truth to make yourself sound wise isn't wisdom. It's the furthest thing from wisdom. It's animal cunning, devilish, conniving. Whenever you're trying to look better than others or get the better of others, things fall apart and everyone ends up at each other's throats. Real wisdom, God's wisdom, begins with a holy life and is characterized by getting along with others. It's gentle and reasonable, overflowing with mercy and blessings. Not hot one day and cold the next, not two-faced. You can develop a healthy, robust community that lives right with God and enjoy its results only if you do the hard work of getting along with each other, treating each other with dignity and honour. I think it's really challenging. I mean, personally challenging. I have to live this. I find it really difficult, actually, to live this. Not that I'm not kind by it, because I'm quite a kind person, actually. I just always was. You know, we're on the kindness meter. I don't know. I just happened to catch kindness when I was a kid. But I find it so offensive when I hear and see things done and said in Christ's name. And it's okay to be angry about it, of course. I realise that for myself. I realise that. But it's not okay to behave in the same way to others. I find that the hardest thing. I can sort it out in my mind. I can figure out what I agree and disagree. I can be passionately opposed to something. But then when the person is in front of me, like those two pastors, good people, I have to find a way of dialing down my outrage and trying to live the way Jesus would want me to live and to say and to do and to be how I think Jesus would want me to be. And so then for me it comes down to how can I help that person or these people to see another side to this. I have front and centre in my mind the issue of gay marriage, yes. But, you know, that happens to be happening at the moment. It's close to me right now because of these twins. But there's a lot of other things that we could be talking about and applying that to. But it's really a difficult thing. And I wonder if it wasn't difficult. I wonder whether it would be God. I know that's a bit of a cliche. But I find that living this life is real easy when you just live it by the tenets, the grab bag of tenets that you can grab wherever you want them. You can just go find what you want to believe. You can find something that's going to justify your position. And so you can do that. I can do that. And I have done that lots of times. The real challenge comes with what would Jesus do? But I think beyond that, I think this is what this is talking about, is how would Jesus do it? You know, Jesus said, I'm the way, the truth, and the life in John 14. The way, the truth, and the life. I wonder if it's coincidence that the way is before the truth and the life. I wonder if the way that Jesus does things is extremely important than just the truth or otherwise that we, as people of faith, often want to be able to get across. You know, I saw Justin Bieber. I was really cynical about seeing Justin Bieber at Hillsong. I was really cynical about it, right? I mean, I don't know what you do. Look, you know, might think, I don't know. You know who I mean, Justin Bieber? Well, I don't really know. I just know through my kids, and I've seen pictures, and I've heard some of his, what can loosely be described as music. And I've done it again. Anyway, I was really, really, really cynical. I saw him, and you know, he was there, and he had a Marilyn Manson T-shirt on, and he was terribly cool at Hillsong. Anyway, so I carried that judgment with me. And I was sitting, not 3 days later, I'm sitting with a friend who is a good friend of somebody, a mutual friend, who's a very well-known gospel singer who lives in the US. Just, you know, that three things of separation. I just happen to know this person, that's all. Anyway, this person says to me, let me tell you a story. And I had mentioned Justin Bieber, okay? Tells this story. And I said, yeah, sure, Tommy. She said, I'm at this worship conference in Los Angeles. This is a little bit before, 6 months ago or something. I'm sitting there, and she said, this dude walks up to me. I don't know him. In fact, I found out later that he was the janitor there, and he just stepped in. And he said to me, now this is, I'm just telling you the story. This blew my mind, right? And blew my attitude and judged me again about the way that I think and act. This guy says to her, phone this mobile phone number and tell the lady who answers the phone, Justin needs to talk to me. This is random. No, Bieber's not been mentioned. This guy has no idea whose phone number he's just given. This is either true or not true. Okay, I know the lady, she's a really honest, decent person. So she makes the phone call about a week later, thinking this is really silly. Turns out to be Justin Bieber's mum. Anyway, he's at Hillsong. I don't know where this young man is on his faith journey, and it's not up to me to know. But I was reminded again that I have no clue about what's going on in a person's life and what's going on in a person's heart, you know, so I just was again thinking, here am I. You know, I would have excluded him out of my community, and yet I'm so outraged for my grandkids, and yet I would have excluded him. And I, you know, this circularity of judgment that we live in, that we really have to be careful that we speak life and love and kindness and not judgment. So, cut the practical things that I was going to mention before we have our chat, if we're going to do that again. Just a couple of things was that be humble, therefore. Start somewhere. You know, I can try to think humbly at least. I find that quite difficult at times, but I can see that the scripture says, I can see how Jesus lived, I can see what James says, I can certainly make the decision to think humbly and to be humble, you know. I can reject the offensive idea that love the sinner, hate the sin is somehow Christian. W.H. Auden, by the way, said, I love this, I love to sin, God loves to forgive, the world is admirably arranged. I quite like that. Don't be scared to reject dodgy doctrine. No, and this is the one where I was last talking to somebody, a group of people, some of them got really angry. No, God didn't send some bears to rip some kids apart because they called the prophet Baldy. No, he didn't. Sorry. Didn't happen. I like Kierkegaard, and I like this quote. If someone lives in the midst of Christianity and enters with knowledge of the true idea of God, the house of God, the house of the true God, and prays, but prays in untruth, and if someone lives in an idolatrous land, but prays with all the passion of infinity, although his eyes are resting upon the image of an idol, where then is there more truth? The one prays in truth to God, although he's worshipping an idol. The other prays in untruth to the true God and is therefore in truth worshipping an idol. That's challenging, isn't it? A couple more things that I see as I look at James and reflect that through my own life is we just have to stop listening to bogus Christian leadership that embraces consumer marketing strategies. We just have to stop listening to that nonsense that commodifies the gospel or commodifies spirituality. Because you're going to be screwed over at least twice in any average year, and there's no point in blaming anybody about it. It's just going to happen. You're going to lose before you win, and you might even end up not winning. I was part of a movement a few years ago. I mentioned the first time I spoke because I'm going to forget the second time. The first time I spoke here, I talked about the old days when I was in the mega church movement, and still, you know, still have very close friends associated in that movement. And we went into this way of dealing with our boards and leadership, which was based on a book called Winning on Purpose. And this book. By a really, you know, decent bloke, it went something like this, and I was explaining it to a friend of mine who's a minister, and who's a deeply reflective person, and who I trust, and I'm telling him about this book, and I said, you know, mate, I've just read this book that we're basing all this stuff on, and you know, it says that, you know, if you're going to win, you need to know where the goals are, right? You need to know where to kick the goal if you're going to win, and this is an American book. So I was talking about, I guess, about gridiron goals. But, you know, you have to know, because if you don't know how you're going to work out when you're going to win, how are you going to know if you're going to win? Because you have to win, you know. And if you win, you should get a bonus, you know. And winning is having more people. So you need to be able to do that. Winning is all important. We have to win. We're Christians. We're supposed to win. And my mate, Ian, looked at me and said, "That's true. That's fantastic. That's brilliant. Oh, except for the person we follow who deliberately lost." And I remember at the time thinking, okay, there's something wrong with this picture, but I just don't know what it is. Finally, I go to Yelling Up every year, and with my kids we go camping. Now my youngest is 16, we still go, and I think they're probably just doing it for us now. You know how it is. But they still go. And but as we were growing up, as my kids were growing up there, because we've been going since my oldest son was about 11, and he's now married, you know, all that. We used to look around, and I remember starting to hear, they'd go out of the campsite at Yelling Up, and I'd hear the word povo, and I didn't know what it meant. And my kids went to Guildford Grammar School. One of them still's there, right? Anyway, there was this word povo, and I came to understand what it is. It's people who are not well off. Povos, I guess, as in poverty, right? And I heard it, and of course I reacted to it like any dad, you know, don't use that sort of language. And they, I don't know what they thought about that, but anyway. But what I noticed was this, that in this campsite, it's just a campsite, right? I started to notice that, now this is a little bit of a generalization, but to be honest with you, it's pretty much true. All the kids that they met as they were growing up, none of them went to state schools. They're all, when you started hearing it, you'd hear, oh, I'd go to this school, I'd go to that school, whatever. And none of them were state schools. And I couldn't help but notice that there was four-wheel drives left, right and centre. And it dawned on me over a period of time that this was a rather rarefied group of people who happened to be in a position to be able to afford to pay the $50 a night or whatever it is to camp, right? I was in Leaderville the other night. We live in West Leaderville, right? So we walked down, and we were watching a movie there on the at Oxford Street. And then we come out of the movie, and we're walking around, and there's people going, you know, going to dinner, and so including us. We just seen a movie and going to dinner. And I said to Kelly, I had this moment where I remembered the camping, and this is just only a few weeks ago. And I had this moment, and I said to Kelly, look at all the people walking around going into the, you know, chocolatier and all the rest of it. I said, who are they? I said, they're us, aren't they? But I said, this is so rarefied. We forget that there is so many people who cannot access what we can access simply by virtue of the fact that we were born with a brain that got us to uni or whatever, and so we struggled our way through, and now we've got the money to be able to go to the Oxford cinema and go have dinner afterwards. And so I'm wanting to live this life of wisdom. I'm wanting to take it seriously, but I'm finding it a challenge. And I'm finding that I do it well some days, and I do it really badly other days. But the biggest thing that I'm finding, the biggest thing that I have found, is that I, with my passion for justice, create injustice by my words and by my actions. And all I can do, but it's not just all, it's wonderful, is to get with Christ, who is light, and say, I'm really sorry. I'm really sorry I've done it again. Could you help me to live this out in my community? So I've said a lot, and a few quotes and things. And I know here there's always a few comments and some discussion that happens. That is right at 11 o'clock. But if there is, then please do so. And I'm not offended by disagreement either, by the way, which I know is part of the thing here too. Offended by disagreement, or by, you might say, well, I thought it was a load of trash, Neil. You might be offended, Peter.
I agree with you that you've got to be compassionate with people who perhaps are against climate change or gay marriage or whatever. And you have to have a way of doing it. But Jesus still spoke truth to power. That's all I want to say.
The things, two things Jesus said were obviously, and everybody knows them, it's by your love for each other that the world will know that you're my disciples, and it's by your unity that the world will know that God sent me. And that's what we're called to. So that has to mean acceptance of people who don't think the same way that we do. even when they are, or perhaps especially when they are obviously totally wrong. You know?
Yeah, isn't it awful that we have to?
But we have to love them. You know, we have to, this is my brother, this is my sister. Yes, we don't agree on all these things. And I actually see that spreading. I see that kind of thinking more and more in the churches around.
Yeah.
Or rather, the representatives of the churches around. I see much more people are saying, yes, we need to make sure there's a conversation going on and it needs to be respectful.
You know, Peter, Peter and I chatted this week at Vice, and we're talking about that sexuality seminar thing that happened a week or two weeks ago on the Wednesday. And Peter and I were talking about it, and I happened to run into, I lecture a unit at a thing, and I ran into a young man who I've known for a long time who was at the seminar. And he's a youth, young adult pastor. And he said to me, oh, geez, I didn't see you at the seminar. And he was being ironic. I said, no, I didn't go. And he said, I did. And I said, oh, how'd you go? And he said, I hated it so much. He said, I thought it was such rubbish. Right? I'm just telling what he said to me. And I said, I'm kind of surprised, to be honest, because he does come from an evangelical ministry. And we chatted for a minute. And he said this, and I thought this was awesome. This is what I'm thinking when you said that, Pete. He said, Chiz, don't stress. He said, my generation and the next generation growing up under me don't think this at all. We have a whole different thinking on this whole issue. We do not think. He said, you baby boomers, you know, you most of you hold to that stuff. But he said, I'm just letting you know. It's not even an issue. It doesn't come into my head. I don't spend time on this. And he said, and I don't understand why they spent the whole day on it. But they're, yeah.
Okay, I'll say something then. Because at one point you mentioned the Pharisees, and I mean, they're one that, you know, when we talk about people we disagree with, you know, Pharisees always come into it. And, you know, we've been brought up with this idea of the Pharisees being, you know, completely beyond the pale, being, you know, utterly evil and wrong in every way. I'm increasingly coming to the view that the reason why Jesus took the time he did with them was because he thought they were very, very close to the truth and still completely missed the point. And he wouldn't have bothered to put the hard word on them if it wasn't going to do anything useful, if he was just scoring points or showing them up to other people or something like that. I don't think he would have bothered. So it makes me see those stories about Jesus using some very blunt language to the Pharisees in a different light. I've got to rethink what it is that he's setting out to do in these situations.
Eugene Peterson, I was listening to him just this week, actually, one of his books called Tell It Slant, and he said the same thing, yeah, which I thought was really interesting. And he said it about the son as well. He made the point that Jesus, in the story, after the story this morning, there's the story of the lost son. Says the coin, the sheep, and the son, in Luke, and he talks about four stories. He said the fourth story is the father going to the son, who was the Pharisee, if you like, the Pharisee son, going in the same love. Yeah.
We've just got time for one more, and then we can keep talking over a cuppa. If that's all right.
Yeah.
I didn't come from quite as liberal a Christian background as I'm now in. And maybe some other people associate with that. And it was not an easy process to get here. There were lots of years of things unravelling, and it's a really painful, traumatic process of having the world and the God you think you know unravel and needing to patch it together again. And any issue, any piece can be the thread that unravels the whole, because it's intermeshed, whether it's gay marriage or whether it's women's ordination or whether it's the literalism of the Bible, whatever it is, they're intermeshed in how they create a religious and social whole. And when we're relating to people who are at a different place, we need to know that we may be pulling on their one thread that's going to unravel the whole for them. And I think for me it's really important to remember what a difficult process that was and not lightly pull at those threads.
That's really beautiful.